Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be speaking to a really amazing journalist, Carla Power, about her book published last year, 2021, by One World Press, titled Homeland Security, De-Radicalization and the Journey Back from Extremism, which explores a really important question. What actually are the roots of radicalism? The book covers a massive amount of ground and yet stays focused on this really key question, right? As Carla writes in the book, quote, "This book is simply an attempt to interrogate what we mean when we talk about Islamist terrorism by talking to jihadis and those who have worked to help them leave violence behind." And that's such a simple opening and yet sets up an incredibly powerful and interesting book. So I'm really excited to welcome Carla Power to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Could we please start off with you introducing yourself, your background a bit, and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I was raised sort of partly in the Midwest, in St. Louis, Missouri, and partly in a variety of Muslim-majority countries and the Middle East and Central Asia in general, and Iran and Afghanistan and Egypt. And I got very interested in how how non-Muslims see Muslims. I went on to study Orientalism in literature. And from there, did modern Middle Eastern studies and got interested in Islamic studies and went on to start a career in journalism looking at writing about a lot of things, but coming back to Muslim societies. And my first book was called If the Oceans Were Ink. And it was about sort of sitting down with a very traditional Muslim sheikh, Muslim scholar, and looking over the Quran together and trying to see where our worldviews, mine as, you know, a feminist American secularist, and his as a traditional Islamic scholar, converged and diverged. When I was done with that, it suddenly occurred to me that throughout my year, 20 years of working in journalism, when people would say, you know, write about terrorism, let's talk about terrorism, I would immediately bat it away. I would immediately say, you know, that's a tiny minority of Muslims, that's Orientalist, we're not talking about the vast majority of Muslims, which is still obviously something I would stick to. But it did occur to me that I had kind of left radicalization in a kind of black box. It was kind of see no evil, hear no evil. And I didn't want to think about it as a liberal who was trying very hard through feature stories and even through news stories to write about Islam and Muslims in a way that in different ways than one so often read about in the headlines if one followed just simply world events, particularly after 9/11. So it occurred to me that one shouldn't just leave the grounds to the extremists, leave the field to the extremists, who would, of course, whether they were Islamophobes or whether they were Muslim extremists, would be allowed to define what Islamic extremism or violent extremism meant. And so I decided to look into de-radicalization programs and look at, step away from the notion of the terrorist as sort of once a terrorist, always a terrorist, or these are bad guys, this kind of binary opposition that had flowered, particularly after 9/11, in public discourse, certainly in the United States and in the West more broadly, and really try to drill down and look at what leads people into violent extremist groups, and what, if any, are successful techniques for bringing them out. So in other words, instead of looking at it as a static system of evil and good, rather to look at it as a dynamic system with multiple factors, both leading into it and out of it.
And so what then, because you start off the book kind of introducing this overall, what you're investigating, kind of what you've just explained to us. And your first stage of it is really fascinating, because the first thing you do is you go talk to mothers. Why was this your first step sort of into understanding this process, into radicalization and back out?
Well, I think, for thousands of years in public discourse, nothing humanizes like a mother. The war propagandists know well to create a monster, monsters don't have mothers. They kind of erupt from the earth and are unknowable, unreachable, and are encapsulated as evil. A mother humanizes. And I also wanted to, the other thing that made me interested in terms of mothers see the long view. And I should hasten to add, I was very careful in the book. I didn't want to reify motherhood and make something more important about mothers than about fathers. But in reality, the only people I could find, the only relatives who were speaking out about their sons, who largely sons, who had joined, the Islamic State to fight in Syria, in the West, were mothers. Fathers didn't want to talk. So I was interested in mothers as this powerful metaphor of somebody who humanized, but also people who take the long view, people who had photos on their mantles of, gap-toothed kids on bicycles, who knew these people before they were drawn into violent extremism, and who also, almost to a woman, had a vision of their sons being able to change, of having known them before they became this thing, which at the time that I was investigating it, this was at the time of the height of the Islamic State's sort of willful and deliberate strategy of atrocities, of burning people alive and streaming it online, or of having a very, very bold and unapologetic shock and awe strategy that they used as propaganda to garner headlines, to scare people, and to capture the world's attention, and capture it they did. So there really was this whole discourse when I was looking at it in 2016, 2017 in particular, of the inhumanity of the Islamic State. And yet by starting off by talking to mothers who, of course, were sentimentally attached to the humanity of their sons, I could at least begin to put together origin stories for how these young people got drawn in.
That's really interesting. And I'm glad you made a point of kind of saying you're not trying to reify motherhood, because, of course, in the book, you do have really helpful kind of meta-analyses in a lot of ways of this nuance that you bring to it, which unfortunately we're probably not going to be able to do all of that nuance justice in this interview. But I would really like to point listeners to that, because quite often, especially in some of these early chapters, as you talk about what you found out in these stages of your investigation, you talk about what you thought about it as well and how it then led to your next stage, which is a really helpful aspect to understand as you kind of take us through the journey of uncovering, as you said, these origin stories, these ideas for change and going beyond the sort of really shocking headlines. And I wanted to ask then about another one of those stages that you talk about, which is moving beyond the individual approach of this particular person and this particular person's mother or relative. You also look at some community-focused aspects, and this is particularly around kind of de-radicalization approaches, but still thinking about kind of how do people become radicalized? Therefore, how do people come out of it? And I was wondering if you could maybe introduce us to one or two of these community-focused approaches, because in some ways we can all kind of imagine a mother who has a child and how they would be able to have a longer view, but community-focused de-radicalization approaches may be less familiar to people. So could you tell us about one or two that you came across?
Sure. Yeah, I remember a real sort of scale dropping from my eyes kind of moment when I first went to Aarhus in Denmark, which has a very famous program, which detractors call Hug a Terrorist program. It sort of flipped the kind of securitized, punitive approach that I had certainly in the Anglo-American sphere had seen, where it was kind of like, get these bad guys, lock them up, throw away the key. Aarhus famously is a small town where they decided to, at least for a time before it became criminalized for people to go to Syria, but for a time, they would, you know, the basic question was not, you know, why is there evil in the world? Why are these people so evil? But rather, they flipped it and asked the question, what is it about our society that is making these young people want to fight and die on a foreign field, essentially? And with, you know, the sort of muscular coffers of the well-endowed welfare state in Denmark, they were able to set up a police program where the police aren't there to criminalize. They sit in this particular detective unit, sits in a little yellow house, sort of looks like something out of Hans Christian Andersen, and basically have a drop-in center for returning foreign fighters and their families. And so instead of criminalizing the whole thing, there would be a detective sitting there talking to upset mothers, frantic fathers, and indeed sons who would come back off the battlefield and saying, how can we help you? Obviously, there is something wrong with the system. Can we help you get an apartment, get a psychiatrist, get a job, get training for a job. And, you know, I worked with one detective who would spend years helping support these returnees and trying to turn them around. And sometimes he was successful and other times he wasn't as successful, depending on quite how radicalized these folks had become. But it absolutely inverted this notion of we have to push these people out of society. The idea was we have to bring these people back into society and show them basically how great the Danish state is. I mean, it was interesting because talking to various rehabilitation officers, not just in Aarhus, but in Denmark as well, there definitely was a discourse of sort of like, Denmark's so great, why would you want to leave, you know? And I have to say, I mean, this was interesting because the backdrop of Denmark, and certainly in the years after I did the interviews, turned much more right wing, and there was much more stringent. I mean, Denmark, you know, now has ghettos where, you know, if you live in a particular community that has been earmarked, and sadly, these are often communities of recent immigrants. You know, you can get a much stiffer sentence for the same crimes as if you live outside of these communities. So I'm not saying that Denmark is across the board sort of all liberal, but these particular rehabilitation projects were astonishingly sort of progressive and, you know, hug a terrorist effectively. So that was my first sort of shock at thinking about how extremists in our midst don't just say something about the extremists. And that was such a permanent kind of fixture of post 9/11 thought, particularly in the States and the UK, i.e. these extremists are outside of our society. They are, you know, they're perverting Islam, they're perverting democracy, they're perverting, you know, civilized laws and civilized aspirations. But when I went to Denmark, suddenly it was flipped on its head. In rather, what did the fact that we have all these people attracted to violent extremism, what does that say about our society? What can it tell us about the ills or the problems in our society? And that seemed to me incredibly instructive. The other place that seemed to have really innovative rehabilitation programs was Pakistan. One of them, which no longer runs, but was running sort of at the height of the Taliban influence in the Swat Valley, which was sort of from 2007 to 2009. The Pakistani wing of the Taliban took over the Swat Valley, essentially. And lots of young, you know, mostly teenagers were recruited. And one psychologist started a boarding school there, which various academics, including John Horgan, who's at I believe Georgia State, who is one of the most well-respected academics looking at radicalization, both white supremacists and religious-related radicalization. He is called Sabayun, which is this boarding school in the mountains of the Hindu Kush, the most successful de-radicalization program he's seen. And I think the reason it was it was so embedded in the local culture. It was so long-term. They would keep these boys for years, and the boys would come in, and often they'd been, you know, they witnessed horrible things. They'd been effectively sort of kidnapped or groomed by Taliban commanders and forced to do all sorts of things, from, you know, being strapped with suicide bombs, with, or, you know, witnessing really horrible acts of violence. And they were put in this kind of British style boarding school, where psychologists would work with them. There'd be cricket and soccer, and art therapy and various other things. And what differentiated this school, I think, from a lot of programs was that it also worked very closely with the communities, so that it wasn't just a question of, you know, you reform a kid and then you send him out into the community. There would be, you know, when a child was deemed fit for release, that the people from the school would go and work with the village elders, or would work with, you know, would set the kid up in with his own motorcycle shop, or would help him, you know, prepare for university exams. And the school had an incredible track record, both in terms of a very low recidivism rate and in terms of actually taking these kids who were from some of the poorest parts of Pakistan. And, you know, there are lawyers who have graduated from Sabayoun. There was one boy who came in as a Taliban, quite high up in the Taliban. He went to get his psychology degree, and he now works as a psychologist with former extremists. He came back to the school while the school was still open and worked as a psychologist. So extraordinary turnaround. And again, I mean, rather like the mothers I mentioned earlier, I think the success of this school came from taking a really long view and also being deeply embedded in the local culture. And that's something that not all de-radicalization programs, there's some top-down de-radicalization programs that haven't worked nearly as well. And that the idea also that one size is going to fit all has been shown time after time not to work particularly well. And Fariha Paracha, who started Sabayoun, was intent on tailor-making a program for each boy, so that it was deeply individualized and linked to the community. So both Denmark and Pakistan were real eye-openers.
Absolutely. They're really interesting to read about in the book. And I'm glad you picked those two to showcase. There were definitely a few others in the book as well that were really interesting. And I'm glad you kind of highlighted the like ways in which they worked and how they were structured, and also sort of some of the kind of obvious limitations, for example, of scale for and funding and time. And so to kind of continue the progression from the individual to the community, I'd love for you to tell us about one of the kind of institutional, or I suppose municipal level things that you saw, which is a town in Belgium that I'm absolutely going to butcher the pronunciation of. But I thought this was particularly interesting because Belgium is often thought of when it comes to radicalization as sort of a problem spot, right? There are certain areas where the population has disproportionate representation in terrorist groups, for example. And so it was really interesting to see the book go to Belgium and yet come up with something of an example of de-radicalization or counter-radicalization. So I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us about kind of what does this look like at the sort of city institution level?
Absolutely. Mechelen is a fascinating example because it's as you say, it's on the train line. The train line between Brussels and Antwerp is sort of the richest seam, was the richest seam for young people leaving to fight in Syria for the Islamic State per capita in the Western world. And, you know, it's a stretch of short stretch of train line, and Mechelen is on it. 10 minutes away is the town of Vilvoorde, which for a time had the highest per capita of towns sending people to the Islamic State. Mechelen according to most reports, had no one. And the reason it had no one, I think, was largely down to a visionary mayor who came in at the turn of the last, in 2000. Mechelen, for a long time, was kind of, I think they had a term for it, Chicago on, and I'm going to mangle this now, the Dilje, Chicago on whatever river flows right by it, because it was seen as quite lawless, a really, really high crime rate. There was a really high, before 2000, about a third of the town had voted for far-right extremist parties because there was a real fear of immigration from Morocco. And streets were derelict. Houses were, little old ladies were terrified to walk the streets. And a visionary mayor named Bart Summers came in, and he realized what he calls hyper diversity had come to town, that there were a lot of people from a lot of different cultures. And whereas that the kind of pat response to fast migration, this had been an all white Flemish town just a generation or two before, when he was born 57 years ago, it was all Flemish speaking and all white. And now, around 2000, it was like 157 different, nationalities, comprised the town's, I think, 20,000 or so people. And unlike a lot of people, he said, look, I may be, he's like 13th generation Mechelen. The whole town was very, very proud of this big cathedral with an incredibly high church tower. And he's like, my ancestors may have built this, and that's fine, but I am the first generation to live in a hyper-diverse Mechelen. And it is all of our jobs to try to live in this new reality and live peacefully and with prosperity. And what he did was, first off, he, when around, post 9/11, and certainly like in 2015, there were horrible bombs in Brussels, which is at the Brussels airport, which is like 20 minutes away from Mechelen. He was like, look, these, and a lot, there was a lot of discourse about, these foreigners coming in and these are new immigrants. He's like, no, this is a Belgian problem. These people have done something wrong. The bombers have done something wrong, but this is our problem and we've got to work together. And he had also taken, he also sort of identified in a way with violent extremism, partly because he had Nazis in his own family. And he would go out and he would talk about his uncle Jan, who had been a Flemish, had been a Flemish nationalist in the run-up to World War II. And then suddenly, because Flemish nationalists sort of sided with the Nazis at a certain point in the war, had lost a son in a Nazi uniform. This had been a very cultured guy who had written travel books and run an orchestra and was a kind of, bourgeois Belgian dream, who went down the rabbit hole of extremism pretty quickly. And Bart Summers recognized that in his own family. And so far from othering the bombers, as a lot of other Belgian politicians did, he said, look, extremism can happen to any of us. And it's up to to build healthy civic kind of connective tissue again. And to do that, he drew from both the left and the right. He put in police. He upped the police force because he said, look, when people feel unsafe on streets, they're going to turn to nativist politicians or immigrants. They're going to turn on immigrants and turn to nativist politicians. So I want to make people feel safe on the streets of Mechelen. The other thing he did, though, was he said, we are going to really actively try to integrate communities. So he, you know, there's a certain amount of school choice allowed for in Belgian schools. And he went out and people from his team actively convinced, you know, white middle-class types to integrate into schools where there was the majority of first generation or second generation folks. And they actively integrated scout troops where they would go out to recent immigrants and say, come on, send your kids to this. This is a great Belgian institution. They'll learn about, you know, they'll learn about Belgian culture and it'll be, you know, and so actively working in a really muscular way to integrate people. He also instigated something called speed dating between sort of older Flemish residents and recent arrivals from various other countries. And they would work together for 6 months and meet every week. And the idea, you know, the Flemish natives would, you know, teach them how to open bank accounts or, you know, how to order in a restaurant and work on language skills and so on. And the migrant would kind of open the horizons of these folks who might never have, you know, traveled to Morocco or Syria or so on. And it worked. And what had once been the ranked as the dirtiest and least attractive Belgian city is now ranking at the top of all rankings. Hmm. It's incredibly prosperous. I mean, as Bart Sommer said, you know, people associate immigration and poverty and degradation of cities. We tore that apart. We showed them that diversity can mean prosperity and rising house prices and good schools and so on. So he really saw it as a civic civic thing, and I think he also was very good at tearing apart the notion of, you know, it's the job of the migrant to integrate or to get along in the society, rather like sweeping the streets or cleaning toilets. He's like, no, this is everybody's job. We are living in a hyper diverse city, and it is everybody's job, whether I've been here 13 generations or I've been here 6 months, to get along together. And it was strong leadership, and he's been recognized for it. I know German mayors were all given copies of his book. He's risen quickly in the EU, in EU circles on radicalization and strategies for inclusion and diversity. So he's going places, and I'm sure he'll, you know, I hope he'll, we have not heard the last of him at all.
Thank you for sharing that example. I think it's really interesting on sort of a larger level, given the assumptions made about Belgium and radicalization, but also to hear the details about the specific sort of policies he instituted, and also kind of the way he framed those narratives for the population of the town. You know, kind of, I've been here 13 generations, but is a really interesting kind of lens to see this through. So thank you for explaining that. Obviously, to listeners, the book has more detail, but Carla's done a brilliant job of giving us kind of the gist of it. And I wanted to kind of, now that we've seen a few different examples, this was obviously also a literal journey, right? You went to a bunch of these places and spoke with people, and in a number of cases, spent rather a lot of time with them, and in quite kind of intimate circumstances, you know, speaking one-on-one with a mother whose son maybe no longer was alive after radicalization. What could you maybe kind of take us behind the scenes a little bit? As academics, we're very interested in like the process of research and how we think about things and how we learn as we go through a project. So I was wondering if you might tell us a little bit about, you talk about it in your book, about how your own sort of background and biases impacted, influenced, how you approached researching this book.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating. And, you know, I started off assuming that I wouldn't be able to talk to any violent extremists themselves. I mean, it was an index of exactly how my lens was the sort of securitized environment in, say, England where I live, or the United States where I'm from, that I was like, well, of course these people will be in prison, and it will be very, very difficult to get interviews with them. But it wasn't until I started talking about, like, I went to Indonesia, for example, where I was invited to a conference of former jihadis, and which both spoke to what a very, very different approach Indonesia has from the other countries that I'd looked at in the West in terms of rehabilitation. This was a conference much like any other conference, with, you know, its own swag bags. It was in a 5-star hotel. There were bottles of water next to our desks, and, you know, a program of events over 3 or 4 days. And it opened with a gentleman who is an amazing social entrepreneur who has been working to rehabilitate former jihadis for quite some time, and has done it in very creative ways. He's helped them start businesses. He's helped them learn about public speaking. And he opened the conference by saying, you know, we have 4 generations of jihadis with us today. We've gotten, he introduced a gray beard from who had fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan, and then some people who during the 90s had been in the Philippines fighting in the jungles there under Islamic groups, and then more recently somebody who had a whole family who had come back from the Islamic State, 26 members of an extended family, led in large part by their 16-year-old daughter. And he introduced the young woman who sort of waved like a prom queen. And that, you know, when I went to Indonesia, he was like, yeah, we're having this conference. And I of course, he's like, there are a couple of rooms, you know, next to in the hotel where the jihadis are staying. And I was sitting here, you know, making my travel arrangements from Brighton, thinking, I really do not want to stay in the same hotel as, you know, all these former jihadis. And so I stayed at the adjoining hotel just to be safe. But and of course, by the end of the 4 days, I was, you know, planning on going with a former ISIS supporter to his old Quranic study group on a motorcycle and stuff, which I didn't end up doing. But I guess my point was that it was so, our own notions formed in the post 9/11 era and formed by the criminalization of violent extremists, particularly in the religious violent extremists, mean that I was so sure that this was going to be beyond my reach. And yet other countries who might not see these people necessarily as as criminals, but as in Indonesia, one analyst said to me, they tend to see these fellow Muslims as just having had the wrong interpretation. And if they can only be coaxed back into the fold of the moderate, proper, peaceful Islam, that is what they see as necessary. So it was shocking how easy it was and how eager people were to talk and tell their stories. So the research wasn't, I wish I could say, you know, it took all sorts of journalistic voodoo to get these interviews, but I was surprised. I talked to, in detail, one guy who, in the United States, who had, gone over and joined the Taliban, and for a time was working with Al-Qaeda and had suggested a plan to blow up the Long Island Railroad. He had grown up on Long Island, and he came back and he did his time, and he served as a CIA informant and testified in a bunch of trials and then got free. And he was, you know, he had done a 180 degree and was eager to tell his story. So I think it's surprising how much people do want to talk and do want to be understood. And the notion of, midway through, I was like, well, I'm going to try not to have anybody be on the pale. And I actually failed at that. One of the conference goers in Indonesia, in Jakarta, was the man I nicknamed in my head, the beheader. He had, during the 90s, when there were great sectarian tensions between Christian and Muslim groups in parts of Indonesia, he had masterminded the beheading of two Christian schoolgirls. And as much as I knew journalistically, I really, really needed to talk to this guy. I mean, you know, this guy had a mother too. This guy presumably had some sort of trajectory towards his terrible act. But throughout the conference, I found myself sort of, you know, ducking away from him and just not getting up the courage. And then finally, on the last day, when everybody else had left, I found myself waiting for an elevator, and he was waiting for the same elevator, and we made small talk. And I should have, you know, if I were really sort of on my game as a researcher or a journalist, I should have engaged him and asked him for an interview and asked him what led him down his path. But my knees were so weak and I was so terrified that I didn't.
Thank you for sharing that. I think it's really interesting, but also kind of helps give context and understanding to the whole like environment that this is in, right? These conversations, these initiatives, going and finding out about these things don't happen in a vacuum. And so the kind of fact that this is all in the era after 9/11 and criminalization really impacts kind of assumptions that everyone has. And I think it's really helpful to kind of surface that. So thank you for sort of sharing that as part of your process. I'm sure I can almost imagine what I'm guessing your face might have looked like when you got that email saying, yes, stay in the jihadi hotel. That was probably not what you were expecting when you opened that email. But I think that the point about kind of how different cultures understand kind of what extremism is, you know, on the one hand, is it, okay, these are people who are just fully removed from society and have absolutely nothing in common with us? Or is it kind of, well, actually, the case hasn't been made about why you might want to be part of the system? Or is it, well, actually, we're all part of the same general umbrella, but there's different interpretations, some of which make more sense than others? I think it's a really interesting thing to highlight. And in fact, in a somewhat related way, you come to a question like this in the book when you talk about some of the people you're in conversation with, have something of an idea that the main thing impacting these recruits to violent extremism is that they were, quote, simply victims of the breakdown of Western civilization. And this isn't necessarily something that the people you're talking to, you know, go around saying, this is everything, this is the entire answer in and of itself. But it was interesting to see through the book kind of how consistently this idea or this possibility that this was something people were thinking about and sort of ruminating on when trying to understand how radicalization was happening. And so as you've kind of gone and looked at all these different things and spoken to all these different people, I'm wondering kind of what your sort of overall thoughts are on this idea of victims of the breakdown of Western civilization.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say victims of the breakdown of Western civilization. I would say that to look, and as you look at people in these different contexts, they are pointing to inequalities or brokenness in their systems. There's a terrific book on how corruption is one of the biggest fuels, one of the biggest fuels in places like in several African countries for violent extremist recruits. Anger at systems where, say, for example, government officials will need bribes to get by, or you see government officials, you know, riding around in huge cars when the rest of the population is struggling to get by. Or when police forces or security forces are hauling people off the streets to imprison them or subject them to beatings. The UN, UNHCR, I think, did a survey of people in West Africa who had joined violent extremist groups, quote unquote, violent extremist groups. And about 71% of them said it was because either a friend or a family member had been, what they saw, abused by security forces or the government. So that real loss of sense of trust in authority and trust in systems, I think, is a much overlooked root cause of people turning to what are dubbed violent extremist groups. When you can't trust the system, or when, and flip that around too, you look at other inequalities that are driving. It was interesting. The head of Nigeria's early de-radicalization program, who is a very impressive woman psychiatrist, said that when she tried to set up rehabilitation programs for folks who had joined Boko Haram, it was the women who joined, not the men, who were really, really hard to rehabilitate, because the women often came from villages where traditionally young women were married off, in their very early teens. And once you were married off, your life was pretty much preordained as cooking, cleaning, and raising children. And she said a lot of these women would be recruited, you know, some sort of commander from the Boko Haram would come by and say, listen, under Boko Haram, you could get a job, you could have a slave to do your housework, you could, you have the right to divorce your husband if you don't want to live with him anymore. And these women saw all these possibilities. And so when it came to rehabilitating people who, were captured by the government and put into de-radicalization, the women had much more to lose because there were those basic gender inequalities in society that they were fighting against that these groups you know, gave them possibilities they didn't have in their own village cultures. So for me, the really important thing is looking at what extremists tell us about what's wrong. I look in the United States and, you know, the rise of white nationalism, and, you know, I'm no expert in that, but what seems to me is there's so many, you know, the basic things that you can see in terms of people joining jihadi groups, anger at the system, or loneliness, or feeling atomized and cut off from mainstream society, or the sense of wanting brotherhood or belonging, or the sense, as George Orwell pointed out, of wanting a cause, wanting something. George Orwell wrote this extraordinary review of Mein Kampf, I think in 1939, for the Spectator or the New Statesman in Britain. Anyway, he wrote it for a British periodical, where he said, you know, one understands that people want a cause. There's the, you know, if it were enough to give people, you know, universal health care and, you know, secure jobs for life and a quiet little life in the suburbs, that would be the end of that. But he says people want, there is a certain craving, particularly among certain people, for a cause that's larger than themselves and for sort of blood and belonging. And Orwell noted, you know, he wasn't condoning that. And he certainly wasn't, you know, excusing the rise of Nazi Germany. But he did see that, that need to belong to something larger than oneself as a frightening but basic human need.
I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind as well when we think about kind of the overall lessons from the book, because obviously you're talking about kind of a specific type of radicalization in a specific context, and yet it is part of this larger conversation about kind of, well, what do people want and why do they want those things and what might they be prepared to do or change in their lives to get it? And I really appreciate that kind of the book talks about those wider things without going sort of too meta and removed from daily life, but without sort of focusing so much on the individual that we lose those sort of threads as well. It's I think, a difficult balancing act, but a really helpful one to kind of make your experiences make sense to the rest of us, because we're obviously not all going to go to jihadi conferences in Indonesia. So I think that was a really useful part of the book, and I'm really thank you for sharing that in your answer in the interview. And as we come towards sort of the end of the interview, I kind of have two, I guess, a little bit more lightning questions, as much as that ever happens in academia. But we've mentioned in this interview a number of different kind of ways of thinking about radicalization and de-radicalization, different efforts going on in different parts of the world. There's a number of additional ones in the book that we've not really gotten into. But kind of given how much time and energy and thought you've put into this, I'm wondering if there's any sort of aspects that you see in common across them, or a particular policy where you're like, you know, that's a good idea that could be done more widely. Or is the answer, well, actually, there really is no one size fits all, and it is incredibly community specific. What would sort of be your kind of overall takeaway around de-radicalization, having seen all these different efforts? Are there ways forward?
I think, yes, I think there are, but they're probably not what governments hope they would be. I mean, it's funny, I think of Germany, which of course, because of its history, has had to think very seriously about rehabilitation, both of, well, certainly of neo-Nazis and more lately of some jihadis. And, you know, it has more, probably more de-radicalization programs than than any other country. There are like 720 programs at prevention of extremism or rehabilitation from extremism. And they are hugely different. I mean, there's everything from, you know, skateboarding and punk rock rehabilitation to people who focus on masculinities and femininities as a central core of the question of radicalization. And there are, you know, predictably long German words that I can't pronounce, with trademarks on them, responsibility, education, and so on, which stresses that former offenders need to take responsibility in very basic ways. So I keep coming back to the sense that it will have to be really, really focused on an individual basis. There are as many ways into extremism as there are out of it. And that kind of detailed, long-term, really individually tailored work is not something, you know, governments, particularly given the economic climate these days, are going to want to look at. But I also think it really has to be tailored to the individual and also tailored to the locality. It really has to be a community effort. One of the mistakes I think that both Britain and America have made is that certainly with Muslim violent extremists is that it has been a top-down effort. It has focused on one particular community and it hasn't been a grassroots effort at all. It hasn't been inclusive. Rather, it's been coming out of fear and fear and federalism, effectively. That it's not been tailored to particular locations. And I think it has to be inclusive. We have to look at it at extremism as community-wide problems, and it has to start in very, very small ways, whether in school boards, whether in hospitals, or there are people who are talking about thinking about this as a public health issue. It has to be creative, and it cannot have the othering effect the post 9/11 era fear and security approach had, because that didn't work. It stigmatized entire populations. It alienated exactly the people we needed to incorporate, and it divided the country,
which is not exactly helpful for everyone getting along or de-radicalization or preventing radicalization in the first place.
Absolutely. And I should say, I don't think, you know, I mean, let's not knock radicalization. Radicals are the sap for change and rethinking things. It's violent extremism and violent radicalization that is the problem, and intolerance and hate, obviously. One of the reasons that I think the United States, for example, has been so behind other countries in, you know, not starting de-radicalization program is because rightly we have long had a problem with the government trying to retrain how people should think, we have, you know, religious freedom is a tenet of American democracy. So getting involved in, you know, teaching Muslims how to rethink about the tenets of their faith is something that rightly law enforcement was nervous about. It's a really slippery slope, but once one sees how many things and how And once also, the other big surprise I had was how, you know, everybody keeps, and I was thinking of this when there was that horrible shooting in Buffalo a few weeks ago, and people kept talking about the white supremacist ideology. You know, we've got to stamp out these ideologies. And the closer you drill down into people who join these groups, it's often not ideology that motivates them. It's much more banal. It's mental health issues. It's breaking up with a girlfriend. It's loneliness. It's wanting to belong, as I was saying before. And this notion that we have to attack white supremacist ideology, I think, falls into a similar trap that we did with jihadi ideology and the dangers of jihadi ideology that we all ran around talking about and writing about in the wake of 9/11. Ideology is a fancy name. And I, you know, I'm not saying there aren't ideologues at the head of these movements. I'm not saying that there aren't very influential intellectual ideas or readings of particular tracts or scriptures. What I am saying, though, is that for the foot soldiers, it's often much, much more banal than that. And we should really be digging down and looking at the same things that worry us about other forms of social ills, you know, loneliness, truancy, broke, you know, families that aren't functioning well, schools that aren't teaching well. It's these things, these banal things, I'm convinced, that we need to look at rather than these grand civilizational theories.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's an incredibly clear kind of recommendation. So thank you for that. Coming especially from looking at the diversity of the efforts you examined, that's really interesting. And I'm sure not just for me, but for the listeners too. So thank you. And to close out the interview, what is often kind of a mean question, you wrote this book. It came out last year. It has since become a Pulitzer Prize finalist, which is amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But presumably, you are working on something new now?
I am. Yeah. Thank you for asking. It's always much more fun to like be like, oh, okay, all right, it's not all over. Yeah, I'm working on a biography of the radical, and I do mean that, radical Islamic feminist theologian Amina Wadood, who has transformed how people read for gender in the Quran. And she's an extraordinary woman. She was she was a preacher's kid from rural Maryland, and she grew up and converted and in many ways changed how people read the Quran in terms of justice and equality for everyone. So it's a real pleasure and an honor to be working on that.
That's amazing. That sounds really interesting. Hopefully yeah. That'll be another book and then we can all read that and you can come back
Absolutely.
And tell us about it.
Great. I'd love to.
That
I'd
would
love
be great.
To. Yeah.
Cool. Well, while you are off working on that, listeners can read the book that we've been discussing on this episode, which, as a reminder, is titled Home, Land, Security, Deradicalization and the Journey Back from Extremism, published by One World in 2021. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Carla Power.
Thank you for having me. It was a real, real pleasure. I hope you will have me back. Okay.